From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I suspect that you each have several mail order bulb catalogs on hand, and also that each catalog devotes page after page to gorgeous photos of narcissus and tulips, often right up front. Don't get me wrong, I love both of those, but today, with help from Matt Mattis, author of the book Mastering the Art of Flower Gardening, we're going to look past those pages at some fantastic but too often overlooked bulbs and bulb-like plants that deserve a try. But first, these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
Before I placed my bulb order, I called Matt Mattis, author of Mastering the Art of Flower Gardening, to see what he recommended. He's here today to showcase some of his favorite bulbs, including the most lily leaf beetle resistant lilies, and also some of his favorite sources. So welcome, Matt. I'm so glad to talk to you today.
Well, thank you, Margaret. I'm thrilled to be here.
So before we get started, Matt, we should say we're going to have a book giveaway of your recent book with the transcript, your Mastering the Art of Flower Gardening. So on awaytogarden.com, people can enter to win the book. And to just get started on the subject, I kind of like to know, if I'm not going to plant them till October or practically November, why do I need to order bulbs now?
That's a great question, Margaret. And in fact, I think experienced gardeners are used to ordering bulbs now. I know when I was young, and I'm a lifetime gardener, I used to wonder why I would get bulb catalogs in June and July. And the older you get, the more you start to realize that time, well, first of all, time goes faster, right? But also, there are correct times to order bulbs. And even though some bulbs, like lilies, need to be planted later in October or November when they're delivered or shipped, they need to be planted early, ordered early, because they are, the good ones sell out. And primarily, I'm talking about the specialty bulb growers. I mean, if you are in the Lily Society or a Lily Society, or you exhibit lilies, you want the newest varieties. And there are, you know, three or four lily nurseries in the United States and Canada that grow their own lilies in their own fields and breed their own. And these are some of the newest and best crosses and hybrids available. Mm. And people know the good ones sell out early. So you order them early. So it's sort of like locking in your order early. And then they're dug in sometimes as late as late October and shipped in November. I sometimes can barely get them in the ground before it freezes. But
yeah.
You know, I think understanding the commercial bulb trade helps, that there's two ways to get lilies. You can order them from the great Dutch growers. You know, I think 80% of the world's lilies are grown in the Netherlands, but they're also grown globally. They're grown, you know, that balance of the 20% are grown in Japan and France and Poland and Germany. So, and a lot are grown in the Southern Hemisphere, New Zealand, for the U.S. market. So they're grown off season. Mm. So they're all great. There's no bad lily bulb, but there are extraordinary ones. And often you get a bigger bulb from a smaller nursery or a newer variety. So those will sell out fast.
Right. Do you have a pet bird?
You probably can hear the 20 heirloom turkeys that just hatched in the kitchen here.
Oh,
and there was no escaping them, so I apologize for the people.
No, it's hilarious. I thought you had a pet canary or something. That's hilarious. Okay, good. We'll say hello to them.
I will. I apologize.
No, it's fine. And there are some things that are kind of perishable. Maybe we'll talk about those with some of the ones you recommend, but some of them, you want to get them really fresh, so you don't want the last thing lying around for months either, do you? I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, bulbs in general, or, you know, I'm including tubers and corms and rhizomes, but there are some that survive fine out of the ground for a while. And there are some that don't. I think we'll probably touch on that later.
Yeah.
But there's one thing I wanted to add, and that this is, you know, this crazy 2020 year with COVID. It's affecting the lily bulb industry, especially the small growers. I just received two emails today from small growers that said, place your orders now, because by September, we're probably going to shut down the site and switch over to spring 2021 orders.
Wow. Okay.
You know, because they're you know, they don't buy from brokers. They're not buying from the big multiplying growers in the rest of the world. They basically have a field of Casablancas, and when those are gone, they're gone.
Right.
So another reason for ordering early.
Right. So I'm, you know, wanting to widen my palette and also to tuck in for the winter with maybe some indoor worthy companions that we can get to later on. But so maybe where to begin first is, you just were mentioning lilies. A lot of people have experienced lily leaf beetle or scarlet lily beetle in recent years. And just quickly, kind of, are there lilies that are a little more bulletproof than others? And what's your experience so far with that?
Well, there's no lily that's bulletproof from the lily leaf beetle. I think what a lot of people don't realize is it's been here in North America since 1943, right?
Right.
But I didn't see my first one until maybe 15 years ago in Boston. And they've certainly been here in the Northeast and New England earlier than that. But I think, you know, we'll have listeners that have experienced lily beetles. We have some that are probably thinking they're ladybugs, because let's face it, they're gorgeous, right? They're brilliant red, and you don't think they're doing any damage. But I think there are people too, maybe on the West Coast or, you know, in desert areas that haven't heard of or seen them yet. But I'm sure you're going to get lots of comments of people saying, I don't know what a lily beetle is, or we won't grow lilies because the lily beetles destroy them.
Right.
So we had them here. Now, I live in central Massachusetts in Worcester. We had terrible outbreaks and infestations of lily beetle. I gave up growing lilies for about 10 years. And then, I don't know, about 7 years ago, they seemed to not go away. But, you know, you hand pick 10, 15 off the fertile areas and the lilies, and then that was it. And I, you know, I'm on the board of Tower Hill Botanic Garden. We host the New England Lily Show there. And I started seeing a lot of the interspecifics or interdivisional hybrids and crosses being entered that had very little damage. Whereas the Asiatics, which are, you know, like your any lily with speckles or spots on it or up facing, they tend to suffer more with lily beetle. So I think it depends on where you live, what you're willing to do, you know, how strong your gut is. If you want to hand pick and squish them, they're kind of hard. But I think all of us have handpicked them off and placed them in a jar of soapy water, right?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, that's still the best way. But I wonder if, I know URI, University of Rhode Island, has been experimenting and releasing parasitic wasps. I think their biocontrol lab, right, has released a few. And that's the talk going around this sort of serious lily growers. We're seeing less here, at least in central Massachusetts, and we're hoping it's because of that, release a project.
But
I haven't seen any data that to back that up other than anecdotal data. But I certainly don't do anything for lily beetle anymore.
So, Matt, there are some smaller bulbs, and I've read your blog for years, and some of them I've heard of, some of the things that you've showcased over the years, some smaller things that nobody ever gets to that page in the catalog, except for you. No, and sometimes me. So tell us about, I think you have a Corydalis affection, don't you?
I do, and it's funny because I still think a lot of people don't grow this one Corydalis, which you'll see in a bulb catalog, which is Corydalis solida, S-O-L-I-D-A. There are many Corydalis. I mean, I don't know how many species, but there are, and there's some invasive ones, and people aren't familiar with them. I mean, it kind of looks like, I don't know, I guess like a miniature bleeding heart, right?
And it's relative, that's its relative, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we know the blue flexuosa, like blue panda and those perennial ones. There's an invasive one in Corydalis incisa. But there are many tuberous ones, or let's say bulbous ones. And my first exposure with them was at a North American Rock Garden Society auction in the spring, a NARGS auction. And they held up this pot with beautiful pink, a mound of foliage with pink flowers on it. And I'm like, what is that? And everyone was bidding on it. And this is when it was the cultivar George Baker, which is common now. You'll find this in, I think, many of the big Dutch bulb catalogs. But I think people overlook these. They don't look like something that would be a bulb. It looks like a small perennial when it grows. But it looks like an acorn when you get it in the mail. And just remarkably easy to grow, but they don't spread, but they form a clump, which can be divided, you know, 3 or 4 years. And there are named cultivars, like really common ones, like Beth Evans and George Baker and Purple Beauty. They're in shades of pinks and purples and whites. Just a fantastic woodland ephemeral.
Right. I've actually found that sometimes, I don't know who moves it, but somebody must move some of an offset or something, because an animal, I mean, not Margaret, but someone, because I found them across the yard sometimes.
They self-seed.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah,
okay.
You need more than one clone for it to self-seed, but the same thing has happened to me. I thought I was moving them by accident, and they're not, I mean, I wish they would self-seed more, but it's more like one came over by the greenhouse door, and one came over where the dogs run through the gravel, and I have actually saved the seeds, and they're very easy to start, but we won't get into that.
Okay.
That they are, they do spread by seed. If you buy two different named varieties, then they will, they do not self-chew when they pollinate, but you need two.
Okay. Okay. So next on the list of the pages we need to get to and not stop at the tulips and daffodils. And again, I love narcissus and tulips for cutting. I love narcissus for the garden. So I'm not dissing those, but
no, it's something, it's really about finding something new to grow, especially, you know, now with COVID. I mean, or if you've been, you know, we're more of us are gardening or we're getting bored.
Yeah. So what would be next on your sort of look for this list?
I would add the wood anemones. Now, you're going to find these listed in some of the Dutch bulb catalogs, and sometimes they just use the variety name, so it's look for the Latin name. This is just because it's not a common plant, so often they'll name it what they want to try and sell it. But the wood anemones are basically anemone nemorosa. I always think of Harry Potter, you know, it's sort of anemone nemorosa.
Okay.
It's a great European species. Now, I'm thinking some people have anemones in the yard that are invasive, right? There's some really nasty thugs. This is not one. I wish it was. But anemone nemorosa is well known amongst sort of serious gardeners. It's a woodland plant. It, you know, at most grows 6-7 inches tall in the garden. It slowly spreads into a loose colony of single anemone flowers, like a daisy almost, but more like 5 petals in shades of blues and purples. Not true blue, but lavender blue or purple or white or pink. And the variety name is sometimes listed as Robinsoniana, but I've seen these in Dutch catalogs as just Robinsoniana as the name of the plant. So it doesn't matter, I think, variety. You know, there's Bowles Blue, there's Lismore Blue, there's the Leeds variety. These are ones I've just double-checked in some of the bulb catalogs this fall that are available. And sometimes the photo's not included, so I always encourage to, you know, Google the photo, see if you love it. But there are three sort of woodland anemones. There's one called Anemone ranunculoides. There isn't a common name for it, but you will see this too in a few catalogs. Maybe you can list a few on your site. But
I want to get your list of sources totally to go with the transcript, because you really shop at some interesting places that aren't the main things that might be sending us all millions of catalogs unsolicited.
So as any of the anemone ranunculoides, or there's one called Anemone X lipsiensis, and I first saw this at a plant auction, but I think of all the woodland anemones, it sort of spreads the best and forms like a pillow of dark foliage, maybe 2 or 3 feet in diameter, and it's covered in sort of a ivory yellowish anemone flower. It just gets better every year, and I divide them after they bloom, and they're expensive. You know, there's no way around that. You know, you might be paying $15 for a dormant pot that you get in the mail, but in the fall, you could also plant these in the spring, but usually you get it after it blooms, so this gives you a jump. But know that they disappear by July or you know, like uh-huh. most of florals in the garden, but, and they're not bulbs, they're really dormant rhizomes, but this is why we find them in bulb catalogs. I guess we should mention the anemonellas, right? Anemonella phylloxeroides. You must have some of those, right?
I don't think, I maybe have one big clump, but that's like about it.
The varieties are like Schoaf's Double Pink or Cameo. Those are two common ones you'll see in some catalogs. So I think definitely would highly recommend those. They can be pricey, yeah, but worth it.
So Anemonella phylloxeroides, did that used to be Thalictrum phylloxeroides? Yeah.
You're good. Yes, absolutely. So you may find it still listed as that, of course.
Well, and that's, I think, the thing. And you mentioned briefly, when we go to look for some of these things, don't just see the name and think, oh, there's no picture, I'm not interested. Go do a Google search, or from listening to the show, go to a Google search and look at the pictures of some of these things that Matt's recommending, because it may not get top billing in a quarter page photo in the catalog or even online. And you have to do your homework before you know which ones you want to get. So for instance, I just circled and wrote down madly while you were talking the Anemone exlipsiensis. Boy, that's a mouthful.
It is.
Exlipsiensis. And because you said it has dark foliage and gets like a beautiful mound and then sort of off-white to almost pale yellowish flower. I mean, it sounds just breathtaking.
It really is. Yeah. And the others are sort of rather slow spreaders. Uh-huh. And that is one, once I saw it in a garden, on a garden tour once, I'm like, how did you get that into that mound? And that's what's best about it. It spreads a little faster and makes a denser colony.
And this is, again, woodlandy, like meaning bright shade or what kind of?
Yeah. I mean, in the wild, they grow under deciduous trees and open forests, right? So it's, underneath a crab apple or not a magnolia, maybe that's too dark. But I have them under sort of in the perennial border in a section where I keep all my woodland plants. So I'm really never digging in there with a trowel. I think even maybe near hosta or something, or the small hostas, really great under hellebores. I've seen amazing gardens with hellebores underplanted with anemone lipsiensis.
Okay. So among the So these are some unusual things that you've been recommending, the corydalis, the anemones, the woodland anemones, the anemonellas. Are you also ordering? We're going to ask you what you're ordering now, Matt. are you, because you're not allowed to buy any more plants and neither am I.
Yeah, right.
Are you ordering any things for indoors that, I know you have a greenhouse and I don't, and probably most of the listeners don't, but are there any things that, it's a weird time. It's a hard year. We're all going to tuck in again for the off season. We're not going to be out in our gardens. I'd love to bring some more roommates indoors with me, but again, I don't have a greenhouse. Are there any things that I could indulge in that could be fun, for indoor? Yeah, exactly. Which actually, right. I love them, but I don't love the smell.
I love the smell.
Oh, but interesting. Okay. Yeah,
but there are some bulbs that there are so many bulbs in at least in New England or on the East Coast that were available in the early 19th century that we just don't see that much anymore. It may be because they had cold greenhouses, but I think generally it's because they had cold homes. You had wood fired homes or coal fired homes, but a lot of these were South African bulbs, and I think some of the best are. First of all, Velthymia bracteata, which
Velthymia, Velthymia.
Yeah, it's another mouthful. Sometimes sold in catalogs as red hot pokers, but that can be confusing because it can be confused with other plants. But it's a bulb, but it's more of a perennial bulb that sometimes goes semi-dormant in the summer, but others say it doesn't go dormant at all. I have some in the greenhouse that go dormant when it gets hot, but regardless, it will grow and very easy as a house plant. It grows very much like your euchomus, like your pineapple lilies, where it's a central crown of foliage that emerges, and then by midwinter, essential stock comes up and blooms with tubular, generally pink flowers. Very easy. In fact, once you have one, it starts dividing and you have more and more to share.
Okay.
So I would definitely look for that.
Okay.
A more unusual one would be Lachenalia, or actually it should be Lachenalia, I believe, because it's named after Varner Lachenal, but Lachenalia or Cape Hyacinths, very common in the early 19th century, but a bit of a challenge to find today. I do have two sources. I know Telos Rare Bulbs carries them, and you could order them from the UK, from Nerines.com, but you'd have to buy a phytosanitary certificate. So I would say for $150, you may want to chip in with the garden club and order them. But these are in the hyacinth family.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful speckled foliage, and certainly could grow them on a cool, sunny windowsill. If you have an unheated bedroom, even better. But I've grown these. I mean, we keep our house pretty cool here in the mid-60s to low-50s at night, and they do fine in the windows. But when they stop blooming, I do throw them out in the greenhouse. But pretty sturdy, and you could treat these like a paper white. So you could literally order bulbs, let's say from Telos Rare Bulbs, and plant them in a pot, and they're going to start growing by the holidays and then bloom in January and February. Uh-huh. So they have tubular flowers, very similar to the Valthymia.
Okay.
I would say if you can find them, the species, anything with aloides, meaning it has a flower like an aloe, A-L-O-I-D-E-S.
Oh, so if the species name is aloides, is that what you mean? Or
correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so
okay.
Lachenalia aloides. And you'll see Lachenalia aloides variety quadricolor. That's sort of, you know, that's sort of the most popular one where it has four colors in the flower.
Okay.
The red to orange to yellow to green in a tubular flower. It's just stunning.
Okay. So about some of those sources, you said Telos, T-E-L-O-S. Is that what you were?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. They're in California. Uh-huh. Northern California, and I just checked her website, so she maybe has 14 different species of the Cape Hyacinths or Lachenalia right now. Not many of the hybrid ones, though. The hybrid ones, it's funny, they've developed a strain called the African Beauty strain, if you can find it. Every catalog seemed to carry it for the past 5 years, but I think a lot of people didn't buy them.
Right.
So they've stopped carrying them. But
right.
I've even found them at my garden center, sold in bags as African Beauties. And I've seen them thrown out by the hundreds at Easter time because no one bought them.
So
just look for them.
So what about a few of your favorite sort of some of your lily sources? Where would I look for lilies among the ones that you recommended? Like B&D is one lily source I've used in the past. What are some other lily sources?
Yeah,
and I'll give all these links, by the way, in the transcript.
B&D, fantastic lily source. Uh-huh. So B&D at the Lily Bulb are two nurseries in Washington State, I believe, right? Or Vancouver area of Washington. And some of the finest lily bulbs you can get there. And I think in Canada, there's the Lily Nook. They sell through to the U.S. too, throughout North America.
Okay.
I would say those are the three specialty lily sources.
Okay.
Meaning those are nurseries that breed and grow their own lilies.
Okay.
And the rest of the sources, certainly all the bulb catalogs that you're seeing tulips and hyacinths, and they have a lily section. I will say a good reason to order lilies in the fall versus spring is that if you plant a spring bulb, it'll be about 20% smaller that first year.
Oh.
It'll grow, but yeah, fall bulbs are much better.
Okay. I have a quick question about my, you mentioned Euchomus briefly, the pineapple lilies, and I went on a binge a number of years ago and started collecting different ones. And when should I repot, like divide them, repot them? Like what should be the protocol with those if you're growing them? I usually just store them in the cellar or something, you know, dormant.
Yeah, repot them when they're dormant. So I usually do it around February.
Okay.
It's a little bit different than something in the amaryllis family. So let's say an amaryllis or a nerine or nerine. Those are in amaryllis or dormant, but they keep their roots alive when they're dormant. In fact, you know, the sort of design. So if the roots are still alive, I wouldn't try and damage the roots. I'm not sure with Eucalmus if I've noticed that, if the roots are still fleshy. Have you noticed that?
I don't think so, but I've done it usually a little later, and I've wondered if I've then sort of thrown it off a little bit. I don't know.
I think I'm a lazy grower when it comes to Eucalmus. Sometimes forget even to take them out of the cellar or the greenhouse.
Well, Matt Mattis, I'm going to be in trouble now. So so I will talk to you again soon, I hope. And thank you for making time. Say hello to the baby turkeys.
I will tell. I'll go.
All right. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
And talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook or Instagram as at Away to Garden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.